Hi, my name is Gabriel, and I'm a survivor of sexual assault. Most people think that rape or sexual assault only affects women, but that's a myth. I'm a male survivor of sexual assault. I was molested between the ages of 12 and 19 by a very close and trusted friend of the family. He was so close to our family that my brothers, cousins, and I considered him as an uncle. He was my older sister's date to win her formal. He worked as Santa Claus at a local mall during Christmas time. But I never thought that anybody in my family would believe me if I told them what he was doing to me. But it went on for year after year. In February of 2001, when I was 19, I went to the hospital to visit a family member who was on a ventilator in the final stages of muscular dystrophy. I was sitting with him while he was asleep. Our family friend came in and tried to force himself on me again. This time he was thwarted by the ventilator alarms, which summoned the nursing staff. That was the last time he laid his hands on me. That night, I returned to my aunt's house and told my family what had happened. I was scared, but I wanted it to stop, and I wanted people to know what had been happening to me all these years. I called my grandmother and told her. Finally, I went home and I told my mom. We both cried. I went to the police department and waited for an officer to take a report. As I sat out in the cold February air, about a million thoughts ran through my head. What if they didn't believe me? What was I going to say? Finally, an officer pulled up, and I was relieved to see that it was a woman. For some reason, I was afraid that a male officer wouldn't take me seriously. But by 7:30 the next morning, the report was filed. The family friend had confessed and been arrested, and I was finally on my way home for some sleep. One by one, family members found out. Most of them expressed shock and disbelief. Many people wanted to talk to me about what had happened, and I told them. Some believed me, and some did not. The trial was a very painful experience for everyone because this man had such close ties to my family. His plea of not guilty literally split my family in two. It pitted sibling against sibling and blood against blood. To this day, some family members won't even speak to me. Around the time of the preliminary hearing, I began counseling at the local YWCA. I talked about my concerns, my family, and what was bothering me. It helped a lot, but I was dismayed to find that there were not very many agencies that were equipped to meet the needs of male victims. Some agencies or hotlines I called would hang up the phone as soon as they heard a male voice on the other end of the line. Most simply said that they only assisted women. This was very frustrating, so I began to keep a journal. I didn't write every day in it, but I wrote in it whenever something important happened or if I felt I needed to get something off my chest. The biggest relief was actually being able to talk about what had happened to me. I had been silent for so many years, and I had kept that suffocating secret for so long. Each time I talked or wrote about it, it felt as though I gained a little piece of myself back. Now, as a gay man, I'm still asked if I feel my sexual orientation stems from my sexual abuse as a child. And I've also found that a common fear among male victims is that what happened might somehow make them gay. I understand that many people think this, but I certainly don't. Just because a member of the same sex does something to you does not make you a homosexual. Being molested does not make you gay. It made me hurt and isolated. My personal belief is that people have no control over their sexual orientation, just like their eye color, hair color, or whatever. Sexuality is not something someone can force on you or take away from you. I've also learned that sexual assault has little or nothing to do with personal aspects of the victim. It can happen to anyone, regardless of age, gender, sex, or sexual orientation. The trial took over a year. In that span of time, my relative with muscular dystrophy passed away. I left the person I was dating, and my family became more and more polarized. Some of my relatives made it very clear they no longer would have anything to do with me. In fact, they did whatever they could do to make my life absolutely miserable. During this difficult time, I realized that family is who you choose it to be. I chose to include in my family those people who were closest to me, my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, one of my brothers, my sister, an uncle, and several very, very close friends. And with a family like that, I didn't quite so much miss the blood relatives that I lost. For the trial, I had to produce several character witnesses because the defense was attacking my credibility and character. I explained to former teachers, employers, and friends what was going on, and I was surprised at how many people jumped at the opportunity to help me out. I didn't think that very many people would want to be a part of a trial like this. I was surprised and gratified to have so many people respond to my request for help. On the last day of the trial, I was extremely nervous. A few final testimonies were given. One testimony came from my ex-boyfriend who, after our breakup, decided to testify against me in court. Witnesses were excluded from this phase of the trial, so I waited outside the courtroom. When all the testimonies were finished, I was allowed back inside. This day was the culmination of everything that had happened in the past year and 4 months. The man who molested me expected to be found innocent. I heard him describing to his mother the party they were planning for when he was exonerated. He talked about the music he had burned onto a CD, food he had bought. Then we heard the closing arguments from both sides. I held my head up high even while the defense attorney portrayed me as a liar and a fake. Finally, both sides rested. The verdict came in. He was found guilty of 21 felony charges. I remember I was sitting between my mom and my grandma. I turned to my mom and hugged her and cried. Then I hugged my grandma and my two aunts who sat behind me. I hugged my two best friends who had come to show their support. With all the ruckus, I was sorry to miss seeing him handcuffed and taken into custody, but I would have another chance. The sentencing hearing came about a month after the verdict was read. This was the time that people on both sides could read or present their impact statements to the court. My mother, my two aunts, and I read ours to the court. When we finished, the judge imposed a sentence of 15 years and 8 months in prison. The judge said the most damning testimony in the entire case was the defendant's own confession. My head was spinning. I held my grandmother's hand so tightly that my knuckles turned white, but I didn't avert my gaze. I saw the bailiff handcuff him. I saw his mother hit one of the deputies with her walker when he wouldn't let her give him a hug. After that, I remember a lot of shouting coming from the other side of the courtroom. I don't remember much else, but that night I slept better than I had in quite some time. Not long after, the case came up for appeal. I only found out about it when the district attorney called me with the results. The appeal had failed. Out of curiosity, I went to the courthouse to review the record of the case. The appeal had been based on the testimony of my ex-boyfriend, who had been discredited on the stand at the initial trial. But in the end, the state appellate court upheld both the conviction and the sentence. That was such a relief. The nightmares and flashbacks have stopped, but some wounds just heal more slowly than others. I'm working on these. Recently, I went to the state of California, Megan's Law website, and typed in his name. There he was in a full-color picture. Underneath his photograph in big, bold letters, it said, incarcerated. It's hard to describe the feelings that ran through me when I saw that word. I felt relief, confirmation, joy, fear, and anxiety all wrapped up in one huge emotion. Throughout the trial, I continued my counseling sessions with the YWCA. It was the only agency that was willing to help me. It didn't matter to them that I was a man. They welcomed me and helped me to process the trauma I'd been through. One day, my counselor asked me if I would be comfortable speaking to a group of new Rape Crisis Hotline volunteers to tell them my story, and I agreed to do it. I spoke for a brief time, then quickly left. A few days later, I received an email from my counselor who told me, because of what I had said at that training session, one of the volunteers had come forward to her family about her own sexual abuse. That was a very empowering experience for me. If what I had shared had impacted another person in a positive way, then why not do it more often? I enrolled in the next volunteer training session and subsequently became a rape crisis counselor and victim advocate. Since then, I have spoken publicly numerous times about my experiences, and I have tried to raise awareness of the prevalence of male victims as well as female victims. I tell my story every chance I get, hoping that it may help someone else begin to heal. I still work the hotline for the Rape Crisis Center. I live my life now knowing that what I have to say can make a difference both in my own life and in the lives of others. I'm not afraid to speak up anymore because my voice was heard and believed. I've even begun to mend some of the relationships that were torn apart when I first came forward. I'm speaking again to my other brother and to other members of my family who hadn't believed me. And some of us are getting along again. That feels really good. There are others with whom I may never be reconciled, but I've accepted that. Most importantly, I feel that justice was served. I feel whole again.